It's the Shay Anything podcast, folks. The show is available as part of the SNY.TV Mets podcast feed. Search for SNY Mets in the iPhone podcast app or whatever app you use to listen to your podcast. Frankly, not our business. Definitely subscribe to the feed if you haven't already. Rate us, drop us a review. Doug Williams alongside Andy Martino. And we don't know when people are listening to this. That's kind of the point of a podcast. But just before we were set to record this thing, we got the breaking news that the Mets are putting Travis d'Arnaud on the 10-day disabled list, partial tear in his UCL. First thing that occurs to me, we hear it so often with pitchers. Catchers is probably the other position where throwing is most prominent as part of their game.
You know the game.
Yeah. Yeah. That's because I've watched some baseball,
Andy. Some analysis.
And I played in high school, which
that's
you also know.
You did.
So it's interesting. It doesn't happen more often with catchers than it does. But for the Mets, whether he decides to elect for surgery, which we know for a lot of people does end up being an option, it's not necessarily Tommy John or not, it's a blow for the Mets because Kevin Pulwecki and Travis d'Arnaud as a tandem had been doing real well.
Yeah, it's too bad. And again, you because this is an evergreen podcast that we hope will hold you for several days, if you're listening to this, you may know more about this injury as the news plays out. Like, to be clear, as Doug said, we just received the breaking news that this happened. But I would say generally about d'Arnaud and Pulwecki, it is a shame. It's always a shame to have an injury to any player on your team, of course. But this is a time when that tandem had been working. I think both of those guys were feeling better about themselves, had taken a small step forward. I think with d'Arnaud, there had been a downshifting of career expectations. When he was traded, of course, several years ago for Ari Dickey, along with Noah Syndergaard, he was a centerpiece of a trade. He was supposed to be a future star. So while we're past that ever happening, certainly he turned himself into a productive role player and had a good dynamic both interpersonally and just in terms of baseball production. He was okay with Pulwecki. So, yeah, it's a shame to see that, of course. Usually when a position player has Tommy John, if that's indeed what would possibly happen, they don't miss as much time as a pitcher. We saw Miguel Sano come back. Look, we haven't had the chance to research this yet, but within a year, I believe.
Didn't Lagares have a partial tear in his UCL?
Lagares had a partial tear in his UCL. Everyone thought he was going to need Tommy John.
His arm's
and he never
better
did.
Than ever.
Yeah, he never did. And that turned out to be okay. So we don't know the percentage of the tear, the extent of the tear, and it based on the initial release, he's still going to be evaluated in terms of making that decision, whether to have surgery or rehab. But of course, when your pitcher has a torn elbow, excuse me, when your catcher has a torn elbow ligament, that's a setback for him.
By the way, just something occurred to me earlier today on Twitter. I was looking, and Miguel Montero was designated for assignment by the Nationals. It's a veteran catcher you could bring in. I mean, Tomas Nito was called up for the Mets, but they're lacking in catching depth, obviously. They have Jose Lobaton, I believe. Is he still in their system?
I believe so.
I'd have to look that up. But, you know, it's going to be an interesting situation. We'll see whether, you know, d'Arnaud does end up having Tommy John surgery or not. An interesting start to his career, as Andy said. It's been kind of a slow downplaying of expectations. But this year, the competition aspect, starting really last late summer and early fall with Pulwecki and d'Arnaud, had kind of increased. And you looked at Pulwecki as probably closer to 50-50 in that catching competition. And it's actually rubbed off well on both guys. So we'll see as we move forward what ends up happening to Travis d'Arnaud.
Hold on. I'm just getting a bulletin. Jose Lobaton is still in the Mets system.
He is still in the Mets system.
Yeah.
Great. Okay.
You know what else I want to say about Travis d'Arnaud, since this is a podcast, we got a little time for going off in a little side lane, is you just, of all the Mets that I've dealt with in the past handful of years, you just couldn't find a nicer guy.
Great guy.
I mean, he's the real deal. He's not great on, like, post-game video, like in the locker room. So the fans might not get the sense there's more to him than you think based on his relatively vanilla answers that he gives to the public. He's just a good guy to chat with. He's one of the only people on the team that tends to ask about you.
Yeah.
Like, how are you doing? Where have you been? That
That's
kind of
true.
Thing. It's pretty rare
and
for
it's
a
genuine.
Baseball player. It is genuine. Just a nice person, so it's a bummer that something happened like this.
Okay, so just back to what we were planning on starting our podcast with. Last week, I, like I normally am, and I was dressed very well.
We can't line this up.
And now Andy's wearing jeans and also a blazer, so I'm confused because he can't wear the jeans on the 6 o'clock show that he's on.
Well, okay.
So you stayed kind of casual because you saw how casual I was.
You were trying to... Okay. So I was in a T-shirt last week. You were wearing a Tux with Tails or something.
Yes, that's exactly
and
right.
And now you made an effort to try to adapt, and I let you down.
I did. I just realized...
I brought a full suit, what you're going to change into for 6 o'clock. Today, this is like the... thinks he's cool CEO.
Yeah,
look.
That's
like, who's
true.
The guy from Silicon Valley? Gavin Belson.
Yeah.
Doesn't he dress like this?
Well,
yeah.
It is kind of like a half and half. Do one or the other. That's how I feel about jeans in a sport coat. It's like, are you casual or are you fancy? Figure it out.
You're an excellent dresser. I try. We have not found our fashion groove as a tandem.
Well, I think I'm going to use this as an excuse to be a little casual on Wednesdays or whenever we record this podcast.
I'm going to square my workout on Under Armour stuff next
time. So we're not going to say the exact record right now for the Mets because, again, it is a podcast. You never know when people are listening. But they're off to their best start in franchise history where we stand right now, Andy. And let's overreact, our first segment of today's podcast. Do you think, actually, I'm just going to say it, this is... the best team in Mets franchise history. By the way,
definitely.
This is, the reason that I say that is because this segment's called Let's Overreact. But, Andy, I mean, it's pretty exciting. I don't think it's overreacting to be very optimistic.
I don't think it's overreacting to say that they're the greatest team in the history of American professional sports. Yeah. Now, can I do this? Can I stop doing the segment theme now and, like, can we have a conversation?
We should just, you know what? We should scrap this segment so, because you always have one line and then the segment's over.
I would imagine that the people want me to, like, analyze the situation.
No, that's true. That's
so
true.
Anyway, look, no, it's great. They're playing well. I think that it was very important. Like, obviously, the question of whether where do they rank among the best teams in franchise history is insanely, ridiculously early to talk about.
Yeah, it's unanswerable.
Right, and we'll find out over the course of the year where they are in the annals of Metdom, anywhere from late 70s to 86, and where are they in between. But what I will say about this team, and I said this on our shows prior to opening day, this team, more than some, needed to get off to a good start for a couple reasons. You got a lot of veteran guys on this team who have the potential and who have in the past gotten cranky about situations. Yoenis Cespedes can be a tricky guy to motivate. Todd Frazier's a veteran guy. Jay Bruce is a veteran guy. Two guys with very different personalities. I could see them getting a little cranky with each other if the season's not going well. Adrian Gonzalez's history as a crank is well documented with the Boston Red Sox and somewhat with the Los Angeles Dodgers. This is a group of people playing for a rookie manager that could either be real gung-ho and into it or super disengaged. So getting out of the gate fast and well as they have was really important because that's where team chemistry comes from, winning or losing. And this to me is a team with a wide range of chemistry options from really bad to really pretty good. Mm-hmm. And winning out of the gate, this is a bunch of veterans. And I don't even mean this as a dig. They'd start playing for themselves, their own stats, their own bonuses, their own careers if the team was out of it. So the longer that the Mets are in it, the better the whole vibe's going to be for Mickey Callaway, who's just trying to learn how to manage in the major leagues.
And by the way, not only is he learning how to manage in the major leagues, but I think he's off to a really good start, not necessarily because he's making all the right moves, kind of the cliches you hear, but also it just seems like everybody's buying in. I mean, Wilmer Flores, he was quoted after they went 9-1 and said, I know something like this, I'm paraphrasing, but I think he said, I know a lot of people are surprised. We are not. And I think that there was a quiet confidence to the Mets in spring training where the rest of us were like, I wonder where that comes from. And I think that does come from your manager. So Mickey's off to a great start. The team's off to a great start. It seems like every time they're down, you know, the Marlins in the second game of that series put up some runs. I know that's a bad team, but they had the Mets beat. And then the Mets came back. Wilmer Flores goes deep. Asdrubal Cabrera goes deep, who's, by the way, such an underrated, solid player for this team. So, no, it's an exciting start. Do not worry about if you're crazy about being optimistic. That's my opinion. You can be.
You know what? For me, everyone does fandom differently. Back before I was in the business, when I was a fan of a team, for me, it was the Atlanta Braves, because I'm a child of the 90s. They were on the Superstation, the whole thing. So I was a Braves fan for a long time. And I always just felt like, I want the season to be interesting as long as possible. I don't want if it's April, I want them to be good, like the Mets are right now. Then stay relevant through May. Then stay relevant through the All-Star break. Then give me meaningful games in September. Then get into a division, take one step at a time so I can stay engaged. So I, in agreement with you, Doug, don't worry about the big picture. Understand, we're looking at what could be a very decent team with the Mets. I thought that they were the second best team in the division going into the year. I still think that. And look, enjoy it.
Yeah.
They're winning.
We have some Twitter questions to get to. I fired off a tweet on Tuesday, just asking for your questions. And a couple of people reached out with some good ones. The first one I'm going to get to is very similar to what we just talked about. I'm not sure it requires more of a response, but at BJ Mendelson tweeted out, is this team for real or an April apparition? And I think my opinion is what I've seen so far would lead you only to believe that it's for real. Well, you know, and possibly especially because, and this is what we're going to dig deeper about later, but especially because we haven't even seen the best of the starting pitching yet.
No, we haven't, and that's good, although the offense will cool off. You know, these things go in cycles.
And there'll be injuries at some point.
Right. Now, building up this record right now is really important because they'll settle in. Everything finds its level over the course of a baseball season. And this team, as I thought going into the year, could have the potential to be a mid to high 80s win team. Let's say they overshoot that. Well, you overshoot it by overachieving in stretches like they have now. That they're piling up extra wins. In 2015, when they went to the World Series, they had, what was it, a 10-11 game winning streak in April? And then they had a really bad stretch in midsummer before closer to the trade deadline. And that stretch didn't sink them because they won so many games in April. So that's what this function is to do. They're going to have an awful losing streak at some point because it's a baseball season, but they'll have some room to play with because of the wins that they're piling up in April.
But part of what killed the Mets last year in April was the fact that they played only against teams from their division and they lost to those teams. They went to Miami very early in the season in April last season, and won, I believe it was in 16 innings in the first game of a four-game set, and then lost. Mm-hmm. The rest of April was a mess. They were playing only in the division, and it got the whole season off on the wrong foot. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens now. And trends, Sal Acotta keeps bringing this up, which I think is a good point. Trends do sometimes continue throughout a season.
Yeah.
Remember the Yankees playing with house money last year weren't supposed to be good. They started off well. They ended up being good. The Mets were supposed to be great, had all the expectations. Started off badly, it ended badly. So I thought that was an interesting point. Jenna on Twitter says, will Brandon Nimmo ever be an everyday player on the New York Mets? The news on Tuesday, Andy, was that they sent him down, which looked very strange on paper, considering he had a 600 on base percentage. Do you think he'll ever be an everyday player with the Mets?
You know, one thing I found interesting, a little detail about that move, was that Mickey Callaway, when he was describing it, said, I felt that it was the right thing to do. Terry Collins would have been like, Sandy made me, whatever the move was. So I don't know if it was just a figure of speech or if Mickey's getting more input on these kinds of roster moves than Terry did, but that's something that I bookmarked as interesting to look into. And in terms of, Nimmo, I think he's proven that he can be okay if he plays on a more regular basis, and he'll get the opportunity to do that more often. I still see him as a high-quality fourth outfielder who can plug in, who can be, look, could he be a leadoff guy on a team? Sure, of course. And he can be a decent center fielder. I like him as a bench bat, too. I think he has that skill, which is rare for a young player, to be able to pinch hit. So I just like him. And nowadays, obviously, these labels are getting a little more fungible anyway. It's like, is he an everyday player? Is he a role player? Is he a super utility? I don't know what he is, but he's a lot better than we thought he was going to be a couple years ago, and that's a nice thing for the Mets.
Is he a little maybe John Mabry-like in the way his career will line up? I mean, John Mabry was a good hitter,
but never... That's a fun name for Mets fans.
Never really started, you know what I mean? That's what I mean. Anything on the outside of his career, just the fact that he was kind of a career pinch hitter, very solid hitter.
Yeah, that's an interesting. I happened to be on the Phillies beat when John Mabry Jr. came out of nowhere.
No, I'm talking about
the older Mabry,
yes.
The father.
Mabry. Am I thinking of, is
oh,
that
Oh yeah, the guy who played for the Cardinals. Yeah.
Yes, an outfielder.
Live podcasting.
That
folks.
Was just, you know, yes. A little miscommunication. That
well,
happens.
And I thought he meant John Mabry Jr. because he was a pinch hitter for quite a few years and not
yeah,
a
and not
fan
a particularly
favorite.
Good one
no,
here.
No, not a great career. John Mabry, I believe, is still the assistant hitting coach for the Cardinals.
Yeah, that's just what I think of when I think career. Of a career pinch hitter.
Yeah, I think Nimmo can be that. There's a lot of different styles. It used to be like Matt Stairs. You like soft beer league, right? Like you come in, you take a big cut, you try to hit a home run, whatever. And Nimmo is more of the archetype of a more contemporary style of pitch hitter where you can come in, draw a walk, work the count, and just be confident and give them a good at bat. But he can start for you, too, if you need him to. Look, he's a good guy to have in your system, and we thought at one point that he was going to be a total flop. So the fact that he's top of mind And one of our listeners' questions is great because he was an afterthought for a few years.
Yeah, I was kind of bummed when they set him down. John Mabry, by the way, played for 8 different teams in his career.
M-A-B-R-Y, Mabry.
Yeah, that's where he and his stats kind of back up. He was a starter at the beginning of his career with the Cardinals. Then he went to a bunch of different teams, came back to the Cardinals and the Cubs. It was a whole thing.
But I think Nimmo can have a long career with the skill set that he showed early on this year.
At Jay Sacken tweets, any early trade deadline targets, never too early. And without being mean to Jay Sacken, I do think it's
you
too
do believe
early.
It. I believe it's too early, too. The way that the timetable works on this stuff is that no matter what a team's needs are, they're not talking trades this time of year, unless there's some extreme, extreme circumstance. I'm sure you can go back and find some early season trade, but it's very, very rare to have a high-profile trade, not only in April, but in May or June, sometimes in June. But the deadline functions as a delay in the league sometimes, because these GMs don't get super earnest about this stuff until the deadline comes really close. And it's like a team can have a glaring need at a particular position.
I kind of wanted to start earlier.
Yeah, well, there's some, like a famous one with CC Sabathia to the Brewers was a pretty early one, but they stick out in your memory. They're pretty rare. Usually you need that pressure. Cespedes became a Met like, 9 or 11 minutes or something before the 4 p.m. deadline that year, because at that point, Sandy and company are in the meeting room going, come on, we got to do something. And that's sometimes what it takes.
Yeah. How would you pronounce this?
Scooter Ocula.
Ocula. Scooter Ocula. Now, I assume baseball players don't have bountiful feasts before 7 p.m. ball games, but I also assume they're not playing on an entirely empty stomach. So what does a typical pregame snack selection look like? A cheese and cracker spread, some veggies, tapas? I'll hang up and listen.
I like this question.
Yeah. Andy, when I put together with Jay the outline of the show, Andy was like, oh, I kind of like this question, talking about it in a totally serious vein. It could be a serious question. I took it kind of as a half sarcastic.
Only Scooter Ocula.
Yeah, Scooter Ocula. I have no idea.
Well,
genuinely no idea.
So, you know, I don't, it's interesting. I don't have a specific answer to this either, because in most big league ballparks, including Yankee Stadium and Citi Field, where the team chef or the team cook prepares the pregame meal is off limits. Like, we can't see it.
Right.
It's behind doors. But I do know that nutrition is something that's increasingly important. So it's not just like they're bringing in Chick-fil-A. There is a carefully thought out plan for the players. Teams have their own chefs on staff. The Mets cooking staff is incredible. Al, Teresa, they cook for the media in spring training, which is one of the great perks of covering the Mets in spring training. And they cook for the players during the season.
Oh, you're getting a phone call from your mom.
Should I take that or should I wait until we're done?
I think you can wait until you're done.
I think I should probably wait too.
Nothing against.
This is what happened when you tried to call me. I ignored the call for talking about a half an hour. Anyway, so they're, and it's balanced. These guys obviously are big on protein. And a lot of guys, like high-end guys, like Alex Rodriguez, who we will discuss in a few minutes, had a personal chef through his whole career, which is, by the way, the first thing I would spend money on if I were super rich. I think it'd be amazing to have somebody cook you healthy and delicious food 3 times a day and not have to worry about it. But some players do that.
No, I think you're right. I would love to have a personal chef, but I don't really care about food very much, so I wouldn't. Like, I don't think it'd be high up on my list.
But you'd
eat
healthier. Like, they'd give you this delicious lean protein with some rice, and you'd be like, oh, God, I love healthy food.
Yeah.
So, keep you out of the Chick-fil-A.
Callie from Mets prom fame came in on the show. She tweeted, Doug, I have a question. She said, Doug, I have a question. Why are you the best? It's just not fair.
That's a real question. Callie, it isn't fair.
Callie, I really appreciate it. I don't think we need to talk about this. I think, you know.
I think that I was like a part of, like, tagged on this Twitter question, and she clearly chose you to.
Yeah, I appreciate it, Callie. Yeah. Thanks for listening. New segment called Believe That. Believe That.
I think you should call it Believe That next week. Doug Williams from Connecticut, but do what you feel.
I'm just, honestly, I'm trying to feel it out.
Okay.
This is a feel out process. The first, it's just, you know, do you believe that?
Okay.
I'm not sure that required an explanation, but I gave you one.
I think you should call it that, is my point.
Do you believe
going
that?
Forward.
A-Rod's claim, we brought up A-Rod and his nutrition whole thing. A-Rod's claim that he wished he played for the Mets.
I believe it, but I know it for a fact, that he desperately wanted to play for the Mets. I've done reporting on this.
What was it that Jim Duquette said was incorrect then, that he would have legitimately come?
Oh, so the Jim was on staff. The Mets front office then was Steve Phillips as GM, of course. Jim and Omar Minaya were two of his top deputies. But it never got to Jim and Omar. This is what happened. These are facts. I've reported on this. Steve Phillips went into a meeting with Scott Boras, of course, A-Rod's agent at the time, at the GM meetings in November of 2000. Boras presented him with a list of what he said were Alex's demands. I can tell you what some of these demands are.
It's going to take you a second to pull them up.
If you give me a moment.
Should I filibuster in the meantime?
Go into a Google doc. Yeah, filibuster for a second, because this will be interesting. I have this information for our listeners.
Pulling up the list.
Here we go. These were, I'm paraphrasing, I haven't seen the document, but I've reported on this. Boras asked for a guarantee that Alex's face would be on more billboards in New York City than Derek Jeter's face. He wanted an office in Shea Stadium for his marketing representative. He wanted a private suite for games that his marketing representative could use for clients and whoever else. He wanted access to the clubhouse for autographs for people, to bring people down after the game to visit with Alex, use of the Mets logo, a tent in spring training in Port St. Lucie to sell A-Rod apparel and merchandise, a private plane, access to the team's internal scouting reports before he signed so he could know what kind of farm system they had, which was highly unusual at the time. That's like proprietary information. He wanted access to the Mets marketing department to see what the marketing plan would be around him before he made the decision to sign. So those were some of Alex's demands. Steve Phillips walked out of the meeting, as he tells it, walked back into the Mets suite and basically said, like, right away, he may have called Nelson Doubleday, one of the owners at the time, or possibly Fred Wilpon, but he said, we're out on A-Rod. And that was it. It was over.
But that was his personal consideration, that list of demands was too ridiculous.
Yes. He gave a press conference soon after where he said it seemed like a 24-1 situation. I wasn't comfortable with that. Phillips is thinking, I've got Mike Piazza who doesn't have any of these demands. How am I going to justify bringing in a superstar who does? Later, Phillips said publicly, and he's said to me too in conversation, that he regrets saying 24-1. He thought that throwing that label on A-Rod was unfair, and that stuck a little, and he feels bad that he did that. But he felt that he needed at that time to explain to the New York media and his fan base why they weren't pursuing A-Rod. My understanding, Camp A-Rod was really surprised by the Mets' rejection. They thought they'd be able to negotiate. They thought this was an opening salvo. And Alex was like, what? I wanted to be a Met. He was a Met fan and a Keith Hernandez fan as a kid. Obviously, it played out. He signed with the Texas Rangers. And he told John Harper, this was treated as a big story when he said this on ESPN.
2008,
John Harper, our friend, had the scoop. Alex sat at his locker in Tampa, I believe, in spring training with the Yankees and said, I should have followed my own instinct and signed with the Mets in 2000. So it's all true, man.
Well, so here's what I'm fascinated by, the fact that, and it sounds like it's not revisionist history, Alex, in the moment, wanted to be a New York Met. But at this point, he's telling it just like he told to Harp in 2008. Maybe I shouldn't have listened to Scott Boras. Maybe I shouldn't have demanded that much. And I'm curious how many professional athletes, baseball players specifically, look back on their career and say, I should have gone with my gut there instead of listening so much to my agent. I mean, agents do a lot of good work,
right?
But I bet you A-Rod's not alone in feeling like that.
No, and there are a handful of guys that actually have a similar pattern with Scott Boras, particularly. They hire him as children, basically, 17-year-old kids,
right?
And they know what Scott Boras represents. Mark Teixeira was another one, and later in their career, they split with Boras and say, I've kind of grown out of that. I didn't need someone so heavy-handed, someone who maybe alienates teams in that way. But it's like most of them do it after they've got their Boras money.
Right.
So, I believe that that's a moral stand if they do it before the big contract. So, but that's one strain of regret. Some guys are regretting that their agents don't do enough for them. We've seen that in this wave of free agency that just passed this winter. So I think that comes in both directions. I mean, agents are, it's an interesting dynamic. Some of them are really, really tight with these guys. Like, I know agents that are like godparents, godfathers to their players' children, and really, really close. Jose Reyes is really close with his agents, Peter Greenberg and Chris Leibel, who works for them. And Boras tried to get Reyes before Reyes became a free agent in 2011. And Jose thought about it, and he's like, I can't leave these guys who I'm so personally close with. So there's just all kinds of complicated. That doesn't really answer your question, but these dynamics sometimes are really close and intense, and sometimes it's just all business like it is with Boras.
All right, last one in this segment that we're going to change to. Do you believe that, so that I can say it easier?
I like it when you say it like that.
The Mets' improved clubhouse culture is a real thing.
As long as they keep winning. I think we covered this before.
Yeah, you did.
In a sense that I really do believe that this is a group that could be sour or can be like having fun and into it. And sour is even not fair of me. All I mean is when a veteran team's not in the race, they start to think about their next contract, which is totally reasonable. You think about your future if once the team isn't relevant. So the Mets have good chemistry now. Todd Frazier is the right fit for a good team. Might be a little bit of an active personality for a bad team. So right now, it's all working. And as long as they keep winning, there will be no complaints.
This week on Keith's Twitter account.
This will be a fun recurring.
New fun segment, but I mean, it's just natural. We're going to talk about Keith's Twitter probably every week, so might as well have a segment
about
it.
That's a lot to talk
about. He tweeted, important notice, attention. Twitter recommended that I change my Twitter handle. I can now be found at Keith Hernandez, and notice the blue check. The blue check had already been there before he tweeted it, but it's just so funny, Andy. You pointed this out before we started recording. That at Keith Hernandez right. is the reason we can all see him, but he's tweeting
we're there
about
already, Keith.
Yeah, we've already right. found him there.
Right.
If you're looking at that tweet, you already know.
Look, this is like 84-year-old senators questioning Mark Zuckerberg.
Right.
There's a gap between understanding and practice sometimes.
Yeah, someone put it to me yesterday, you know, questioning Mark Zuckerberg with senators. Like, by the way, could you stay after? I can't get my computer to restart.
Right, exactly.
It's just such a funny,
no offense,
like,
Keith, but,
no, yeah. Not,
and you're not 84.
Not related
close.
To Keith at all. But, you know. Yeah, his Twitter still is gold. And by the way, after the Mets sweep of the Nationals, his stuff on Jacob Rame getting the call to come in and save that game, Mickey Callaway's decision to do so good. So
did
follow
you know
Keith Hernandez.
That Keith's Twitter was like a Yahoo News story? I went to check my email.
Yes. And well, it was the Daily News wrote about it. A bunch of people did.
Yeah, it's like a crossover story yeah. now, where it's not just like a cute little thing that we're talking about at SNY.
No.
But like, yeah, it's mainstream, man.
Before we get to our Saturday nights, let's dig a little deeper, our final actual baseball segment of the show. Starters are not going deep into the games, Andy. The Mets are winning really without dominant starting pitching. And I tweeted last night that I think it's interesting that we know probably the Mets will eventually live and die by their starting pitching. But at least for now, we get to kind of toss aside that narrative and know that they have the talent when everything's going right to win games necessarily without it.
Hey, look, I think it was on our opening day show. We were talking about keys of the season, and I actually thought it was going to be their offense because of...
Oh, look at you.
Well, look at you tweeting all insights last night. Look, we're both here to self-promote. Let's not pretend this is anything other than that. Give ourselves a little pats on the back. But I think that's playing out, not only because I'm like a brilliant baseball mind.
Right, I am, and former player.
Right, but because the starting pitching's been fine, it's been decent, it hasn't lived up quite to the billing, of course, yet. But that offense is the thing that swings. It's sort of like the clubhouse culture. That's a lineup that can be really pretty good or really terrible, depending on what these veterans bring. And so far, it's been pretty good. The Syndergaard and DeGrom stuff has been a little strange because their stuff has been pretty good. You watch them, they look like themselves. They seem completely healthy. They're just not quite missing bats. So we talked about Syndergaard a little over the past week or so, and there isn't a possibility there that he's pitching for strikeouts a little too much. Because if he were to try to induce contact, he would get fewer foul balls. He'd get his pitch counts down. He might be able to go deeper into games. And that would solve that. DeGrom had, I think Callaway called it a funky inning, you know, where he gave up the lead against the Marlins. I think Jacob DeGrom, just the year in, year out, the more I watch him, the more I don't doubt that guy.
Yeah, he's a stud.
So we'll see what Syndergaard can do and how he can adapt. But, yeah, I think the fact that they're collecting wins, again, without the starting pitching being dominant, and they've got 9 wins as of this taping. Could be more by the time you listen to it. And if you have that without your main asset, your starting pitching being what it could be, then that's just money in the bank for
you. I guess the only reason this is surprising is the 1 and 2 guys, like you talked about.
Yeah.
DeGrom and Syndergaard just haven't been the dominant starting pitchers that we went into the season thinking they would be. It was almost like automatic. And it's partially because in spring training they look so dominant, but it's not like we thought really anyone other than those two would be great to start the season. That part's not surprising. It's just that DeGrom's pitching a little bit like he was 2 years ago, which was, you know, he'd grind out 6 innings, 2 runs, keep you in the game. His ERA at the end of the year was great, but it wasn't easy for him. Noah Syndergaard in spring training, I thought, looked a little bit better than he has so far in the regular season. And also, it's interesting that they pitch in cold weather and then go straight down. While increasing their pitch counts, they go to a humid, new regime, Miami and Marlins Park, that's open in the humidity. That's got to be something. I mean, maybe we care too much about temperature. We've talked a lot about temperature.
I think pitchers care about temperature.
Yeah.
I mean, I know hitters care about temperature when the pitcher throws it in on their hands. And it affects results in baseball. But I don't know. I'm interested in Harvey, too. I'm interested in,
yeah,
is that optimism that he came into the season going to sort of slowly diminish? Is his results going to tail off? We may be seeing a little evidence of that. Is he okay? That continues to be a fascinating thing to watch. This team's not going to go that far without their top two and then a third guy, whether it's Mats or Harvey or Jason Vargas or someone having a really good year. So that will have to ultimately straighten itself out for sure beyond what it is.
I'll tell you what, I'm pumped about Gastelman and Lugo because I like in baseball when people are like demoted technically but actually promoted
into a role that fits.
Like, Gastelman and Lugo have to realize, and I hope they do, that the only reason that they're still in the bullpen is because of how good they are and how good they've been. Because we so often treat the starting rotation as the place where everybody wants to be. It is, Andy, the place where you make the most money, so obviously a lot of people want to be there.
That shouldn't matter. It's all about winning.
Right, but like, God, you think he's serious, and then you just...
I had him there for a second.
But they are where the Mets need them to be, and Mickey Callaway has found that they're a really good tool.
Hey, at this stage in their career, believe me, big league life in the bullpen is better than AAA life as an ace for Las Vegas. So, yes, it's working out great. They're showing their worth. Obviously, if there are injury issues in the rotation, there might have to be a different conversation about their role going forward because they're capable starting pitchers. But right now, it's been great. That has been bullpen depth that we didn't see coming, which is why we rated going into the season the Met bullpen is so much worse than the Yankee bullpen, because we didn't see that depth because we thought of those guys
even
as their sixth and seventh starters.
Brilliant baseball minds like us didn't see that part coming.
You miss one every once in a while.
Yeah, it's just right over. All right, so
I said Stan's going to hit 70 home runs. He may, over the course of that contract, hit 70 home runs.
I feel a little bit ridiculous for being part of that crowd after the Stanton series in Toronto.
It was a very exciting day for the Yankees.
Yeah.
It was.
But, you know, I'm guilty of it. You know, I was asking people on our show, you know, will he hit 70? And
I said yes.
Just such an overreaction.
Well,
we shouldn't.
This is not a Yankee show, but I think Giancarlo is going to be okay.
Yeah, I do too. Let's go to my Saturday night. Every week we talk about what we did on Saturday night. This is, by the way, I picture a sea of humanity that just listens to us to get
for
Mets
this.
Talk. Just to get Mets talk,
mm-hmm.
And then now they just turn the show off.
No. I don't think so. I think they fast forward to this.
Okay. I hope you're wrong, sort of. I'll start, Andy, my Saturday night. I actually, on a cold weekend, just doesn't seem to be warming up, although this upcoming weekend looks to be warm, but I went down to the Jersey Shore for a little getaway with my girlfriend and another couple, relaxed. We actually played some board games and watched TV and made dinner. It was very fun.
That sounds nice.
Yeah, it was nice.
That sounds nice. I had a nice
Saturday. That sounds nice, not cool.
No, well, it depends on your friends and I was going to say what board games you played, but no, there's no way that's going to be cool.
No, I don't want to get into that.
Mine was nice. You could tell me it was cool or not, but let's see. Late afternoon, early evening, I went into the Brooklyn Museum with my son. There was an exhibit of it was like a video installation of pilgrimages to Mecca through the years. It was really cool. My kid,
Boy, I'm sure your kid was so into that.
No, he was into it. I couldn't get him out of the room.
I couldn't get enough of pilgrimages to Mecca
It was interesting. And he liked the fact that it was a screen. But anyway, so we looked at the permanent collection, too. He likes to look at paintings. We like to do that together. Then we came home. He went to bed, and my wife and I watched The Florida Project on demand, which wasn't a wild Saturday night, but good movie.
But that's exactly what you thought the My Saturday Night segment would be going into this. That was
this is more in line with
what your normal
our expectations were. But I did go all the way into Brooklyn, go to a museum. So there was some non-lazy middle-aged effort shown there by me. Can you give me that?
Yeah, maybe. But that's just what I would have guessed that you would have done on a Saturday.
Well, we know each other.
Yeah. That's true.
So the gap is narrowing. We're not going to belabor this, but the first two Saturday nights, I was so much younger and cooler than he was, even though he's a decade younger than I am. And now we're finding our levels a little bit.
Isn't it interesting how at a certain point in life, a decade of years difference doesn't matter as much as it would have?
Yeah, but we're not there yet. You're 27. And I'm 37. It still matters. Not so much with you, though, because you're not that cool.
We had a conversation off air the other day about if it would be weird if I had people over to my apartment and you were there.
Because I went to a 50th
birthday party. Specifically that you're 37.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there's any difference between a 33-year-old being in my apartment and a 37-year-old being in my apartment. I think both are okay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you'd get weird stares unless you brought, like, your son. And be like, oh, there's a dad here.
Your friends don't like children?
No, it's just like, that's a good way to age yourself.
That's a line, the parent thing. Okay, I'll give you that.
Yeah, that's just my opinion.
What board game did you play?
We started with, oh, man, I really did not like the first game we played. It was like Rubik's Cube or something like that. You know what I'm talking about?
No. All right. Thanks for joining us.
No, but we played Apples to Apples.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, I love Apples to Apples.
Yeah.
Big fan.
Yeah.
Good, like, group cohesion game. And sense of humors.
Right. So anyway, feel free to fast forward to the end of the podcast this week.
I'd
rather enjoy the self-indulgent aspect.
Don't forget, everybody, the show's available as part of SNY.TV's Mets podcast feed. Search for SNY Mets in the iPhone podcast app. This will come up with a couple of other podcasts that we do here on the network. Give that a subscribe and give us a rate and review, too. That really helps for some reason, I think.
What is the reason?
Well, I think if you give us a positive review, we get into this every week. You seem to be fascinated. Andy, by the way, has not yet subscribed to the podcast.
Apparently, he's just not totally
convinced yet. So hopefully by this time next week, he'll be an actual subscriber with all of you. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll be back with you next week, we hope.
Goodbye.